welcome to this week's Who the Folk podcast. I'm Lonnie Goldsmith, the editor of TCG Folk. This week I talk with Sean Aronson, the play-by-play voice of the St. Paul Saints. We talk about how he got a start in baseball, what brought him to the Saints, and about that time his family put out an APB on him on this week's Who the Folk podcast. But before we get to Sean, picture this. Israel, 2022. A crowded bus breaks down on the side of a desert highway. Who is sitting next to you, and what secret will they reveal? The newest podcast from Unpacked, Homeland, 10 Stories, 1 Israel, will keep you on the edge of your seat as each passenger's story unfolds. Meet the Russian immigrant who escaped the Soviet Union, and the Jerusalem native whose family traces back more than 400 years. Each week, you'll meet a new character whose story will take you for a ride. So get on the bus, grab a window seat, and settle in for Homeland, 10 Stories, 1 Israel, wherever you get your podcasts. Sean Aronson, welcome to the Who the Folk podcast. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
And thank you for having me here in your office at CHS Field. It is a gorgeous space, the home of the St. Paul Saints, where you are the broadcaster, and there's more to the title than that.
Yes.
I guess sort of tell me what the day-to-day job is for you,
particularly
in season like we are now.
Yeah, it's crazy, to be honest with you. I work 15-hour days, and I don't say that for anyone to feel bad for me. And
right.
It's not like I work 15-hour days like one day a week or 4 days a week, but pretty much every day with the exception of Monday, because Monday's the traditional off day in the league.
Okay.
But I'm still probably working 8 or 9 hours on Monday. So truthfully, during the season, for doing what I do, there is no day off. And
right.
Again, I don't say that for anyone to feel bad. Like, I love my job. I love what I do. But we're talking right now on September 2nd. The season ends on the 27th. And I can't wait for the season to be over.
Right. I mean, we're talking at the end of what has been a 5 or 6 month,
yeah,
just day in, day out, yes, grind.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're talking to me on a day that we just played 3 hours and 25 minutes last night, which is unusual, because now the world of baseball and the minor leagues has a pitch clock,
right,
which speeds up the games. But I think it's now, on Saturday, I'm trying to remember now what day it was, we played 3 hours, 44 minutes. And then last night, which would have been Thursday night, 3:22. So we've had a couple of lengthy ball games over the last few days. So
and
I'm
at this point,
it.
And at this point, I'm sure the days just sort of blend together at a certain point, right?
Yeah, I'm lucky. When I wake up, I know what city I'm in sometimes. it's tough.
Well, and the new way that baseball is scheduled, and we're sort of jumping around a bit,
yeah,
but the new way this is scheduled is you're in a city basically for a week.
Yeah.
Monday's the travel day.
Yep.
You play Tuesday through Sunday.
Yeah.
And then Monday you travel either in the same place, as opposed to the way it used to be, which was 3 or 4 games here, or four games there, and you sometimes are home, away, home in the same week.
Yeah. Yeah, so the major leagues still do that, obviously.
Right.
I don't think they'll ever go to a 6-game series, but it saves on the travel costs in minor league baseball.
Mm-hmm.
To be honest, it makes all the sense of the world. I can't speak for anyone else, although the players told me they like it.
Okay.
Coaching staff, managers like it. I love it, because you can get settled into a city.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to worry about checking out of a hotel on, like a Wednesday or Thursday afternoon at noon when you have a 7 o'clock game that night.
Yep.
And so usually your Sunday games are afternoon games. So you don't have to worry about checking out and what are you going to do for 4 hours.
Right.
And it just makes it easy. Now, the tough part is when you've got the 2-weeker either at home or on the road, that seems like forever when you're in one spot for 2 weeks. So, when you're on the road for 2 weeks and you don't have the luxuries of your home,
mm-hmm,
or when you're home for 2 weeks and you're like, I'm just ready to get out of here because you're doing so much.
Right.
That's the tough part.
And that's you've been doing this for 23 years, right? 22 years now.
If you want to count my intern year, 23.
But we'll count your intern year.
Sure.
You work. That counts.
Sure, true.
So for 23 years you've been doing this, and this sort of scheduling convention is fairly recent.
Yeah, last year.
So you've spent most of, all but 1 or 2 years of your career, sort of this 3 days here, 3 days there situation.
Yeah, and so I didn't know any better, right?
Right.
Like you don't know.
That's right.
Until last year, we became a AAA affiliate, and they're like, here's what we're going to do to cut down on travel costs. And people were a little skeptical because the big fear was when you play the same team 6 straight times, they were worried about bench clearing brawls. They weren't worried about anything else, but
interesting,
because the animosity over the course of 6 days can build up,
I suppose.
And so they were, but I think that's been negligible. The biggest problem has been with the umpires, right? You get a bad umpiring crew and they're there for 6 days.
Oh, that
causes some
tough
issues. And I'm not placing any blame on the umpires, but I think that's been more of an issue than any sort of animosity between the two teams.
And I would think also from a baseball strategy perspective, you're seeing the same starters. You're seeing at least one starter twice, probably.
Yeah, it's hit or miss on that. A lot of teams, especially in the minor leagues, go to a six-man rotation because they need innings for all these guys.
That's true.
We've probably done it a handful of times this year where the same starter on Tuesday is the same one on Sunday.
Okay.
But you're right. There is a lot of familiarity. I mean, we're playing right now, as we talk, the Omaha Storm Chasers. We play them more than any other team this year. We play them 27 times. But it's
a lot.
You're right. But as my manager told me yesterday, as Toby Gardenhire told me when I asked him about that, he's like, look, this team, as well as us, is very different than the team we were in May. There's so much turnover at AAA that, you know, you probably get seven or eight guys that are the same. It's funny because on Tuesday we go to Toledo. We have to resume a game that was played here 2 months ago that was rained out in the first inning. I went back and I looked at the starting lineup on that day, and mm-hmm. five guys are no longer here. One guy got traded, is with the Reds, and just got called up to the big leagues. I mean, it's so funny to look back, you know, and I'm sure the same is going to hold true for Toledo.
Oh, I would imagine. It's, I mean, and that's the minor leagues.
Yeah.
That's sort of the one of the vagaries of baseball at this level, is that happens. So you've been with the Saints for 15 years. 16 years.
Yes.
My apologies. For all but two of those years now, it was an independent team.
Yeah.
It was the quirky...
Yeah.
The bizarre, you know, promotions, the fun-loving sort of shenanigans that, you know, I think a lot of people associate with minor league baseball. Sure. The last 2 years have been the AAA, you know, gone from sort of independent baseball mm-hmm. to the AAA affiliate of the Minnesota Twins, yeah. which is a pretty huge jump.
For sure.
In that, how has it been these last couple of years being under the auspices of a major league franchise?
Yeah, look, the big thing was we didn't want to lose our identity. And the Twins said as much in the press conference that mm-hmm. started this off, that they wanted to make sure we didn't change who we were. As a matter of fact, they encouraged for us to be, you know, the crazy and the wacky that everybody, you know, has grown to love since 1993. And I think we've done a fairly good job at that. Look, you're still under the umbrella of Major League Baseball. Mm-hmm. Forget about the Twins. The Twins have not told us we can or can't do anything. But Major League Baseball will step in from time to time and be like, nope, sorry, cannot do that. And on top of that, you have to run every promotion by Major League Baseball. They have to sign off on everything that you do. Now, look, there are easy ways to get around these
sure.
things, but they still have to approve everything. So it is different on that front. Because mm-hmm. For people that do not know, Major League Baseball now runs Minor League Baseball. That was not the case up until last year.
Right.
Minor League Baseball is its own separate entity. So I think we've done a good job. I tell this to people all the time. The Twins are not majority owners of the Saints. They bought a minority stake in the Saints when we became their AAA affiliate. But it's a minority stake, and they are about as silent partners can get. So it's still owned by the same ownership group that we've had since 93. The front office is pretty much the exact same as it was last year, and since we moved into CHS Field. So the people that have come up with these crazy ideas are the same weird people that are still here.
Okay.
So I have not, I mean, I've got the most contact, maybe outside of our general manager, with the Twins, like, front office people, because I got to deal with their media relations folks.
Sure.
But otherwise, outside of them coming out to a game here, they've never stepped foot in this office. I mean, if they'll come, they'll come to a game, check out, you know, the players and stuff mm-hmm. like that. But outside of that, they are not here at all.
I would think one of the biggest differences is obviously going to be on the field, because now there's definitely yes. a more developmental bent to yeah. what the Saints are doing as opposed to when they were an independent team.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, look, when we were an independent club, our manager, George Samus, who is an amazing guy, mm-hmm. He put the roster together. He went out. It was like college recruiting. That's how
right.
it was. That's how you find independent players. Here, obviously, the Twins draft these players, sign them as free agents, make the trades, and they put their players where they want within their minor league system. So we have no say over the players. And that's, you know, that's fine with us. We're hands off when it comes to it.
So this is your second stint working sort of in the Twins
yeah.
organization. Again, you know, you were here before the Twins were with
yes.
the Saints, but you were you held this role with Fort Myers yeah. in single A.
Yeah, yeah. And
in the early 2000s.
Yeah, the two are not related. It just right. sort of happened that way.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, I was in Fort Myers from 03 to 06. Mm-hmm. At the time, they were the Twins high A affiliate. They are now the Twins low A affiliate. And at the time, the ownership group that owns the Saints owned the team in Fort Myers. They've since sold it about, I think they sold it four or five years ago now. So when this job opened up, my predecessor is Chris Atterbury, who's now sure. doing the pre and post for the Twins and some fill-in work. They opened it up only to the teams that they own. So they owned five or six teams at mm-hmm. the time and talked to all the broadcasters, interviewed them all, and spoiler alert, I got the job. Here I am. And that's how it happened. But, yeah, I spent 4 years there. So I knew some of the folks in the Twins front office already. I mean, mm-hmm. the Twins are very famous for really keeping their core together. A lot of those folks that were there when I was in Fort Myers, like, you know, the brass with the Twins, yeah. a lot of those folks are still there today.
Sure.
And so so that helped the familiarity. It also helped that, you know, we've been here for so long.
Right.
And the relationship between the Saints and the Twins was not always a good one. In the 93 year, when we first moved in, mm-hmm. The Twins probably thought nothing of us until we became successful, which was almost right away. And then there was some animosity, and that slowly died off, and now you got a great working relationship.
Yeah. Now, I've been in the Twin Cities since 2002, but mm-hmm. have been visiting my whole life. I've family here, so, you know, I sort of, you know, the Saints, I remember when they came in, they were the outdoor baseball team, because the Twins had the Metrodome, yeah. which was, as somebody who's gone to baseball games there for, had gone there for many, many years, was just about the most stale baseball environment you could have. Yep. So the fact that you had even an independent minor league team playing outdoors was such a huge draw.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. Obviously, it was before my time, but I've heard enough about it, and I was around when, obviously, Target Field was built.
Sure.
And that changed the whole dynamic of the outdoor baseball. And Target Field hurt us, you know, when it was built. It yeah. hurt us for 2 or 3 years. We sort of, I don't want to say we have to revamp what we did, but we had to come at it from a different angle. But here's the thing. If we came in 93 and said, hey, come watch baseball outdoors, we wouldn't have been successful.
Right.
It was, come watch the wacky and the quirky while sitting outdoors. And it was never about the baseball. And for us, it's still not about the baseball. We still promote the entertainment side of things.
Sure.
Now you just get more of a crossover of baseball fan and entertainment fan, whereas before this, it was pretty much entertainment fan with a little bit of mixture of baseball fan in there.
You've spent your entire career working in minor league sports, baseball especially, yeah, and you've done some college broadcasting yeah. as well, but the majority of your career has been in minor league sports. People think, oh, you work in sports. That's so fun. That's so glamorous. And I'm sure those people think of it as only at, they're thinking of just the highest level.
Sure.
I am sure it is not as glamorous as most people think it is. Is
not
that correct?
At all. you know, I think what people see, especially for me, mm-hmm. they see my primary job as a broadcaster and are like, that's so cool, or I could do that, or I want to do that, whatever, which is great.
Sure.
I love that. I love hearing that. But I don't walk into this ballpark at 6:45 for a 7:07 game and put a headset on and just go. What they don't see, and this is the case for any broadcaster, mm-hmm. is all the off-season work that you put in. I mean, forget about in-season. All the off-season prep work that you're doing to get ready for a season. I mean, I start my prep work probably 2 months out doing research on, A, every guy that the Twins could potentially have at AAA, every free agent that they wind up signing that could wind up playing for us. And then I start working on all the teams that we're going to play and research on their players so that I have something, you know, ready to talk about these guys. But I say this to everybody. The day-to-day minutia of this job will kill you.
You're really selling it for folks listening.
But that's the thing. Like, nobody ever sees this. And again, I don't want to come across as someone that's not grateful for what I do. I love my job. I love the broadcasting side of this job.
Sure.
I even enjoy at times the media relations side of this job. But I don't enjoy pulling a tarp when it rains. I don't enjoy setting up a ballpark at 3:00 and wiping down picnic tables that have bird poop all over them. And this is all reality. This is all what we do. Like, minor league baseball is if you look at the Twins And, you know, their media relations director, their communications director, Dustin Morse, who's incredible. Yeah. He's award-winning.
Fantastic.
He's amazing.
Yes.
But he's got 17 people to work under him. I'm me and that's it. Like, there's nobody
else.
You
are those 17 other people.
Yeah. So, like, it's – but you're doing that, mm-hmm. the work of X amount of people, while also picking up the phone and answering ticket calls. I do sales. So I do corporate and group sales as well. So you have to take care of your clients
sure.
as well. And like I said, setting up while traveling on the road. So it's tough. And again, I'm not saying woe is me.
Right.
I'm just saying this is the reality of the job.
Right.
But the Zen moment for me, if you will, the reason I'm in this business is to put on that headset at 7:07 where no one can tell you what to do, where I don't have to answer to anybody, where I'm not picking up a ticket call, where I'm not, you know, there's no fan interaction there.
Right.
It's just me, the game of baseball, and the viewer and the listener. And I always tell people there is no more intimate relationship than that, and that's what I appreciate about this job. In January and February, when nobody's thinking about baseball and it's minus 20 degrees, the thought of jumping on the broadcast in early April is what gets you through those cold months.
Yeah. I mean, and like you can I can see the yep. field from
yes.
from where I'm sitting in
yeah.
your office. You can't, yeah. but like you stand up and take a look outside in January, you can see the snow piled up on the field.
Yes, you
there
can.
Is nothing pleasant about that, no. I'm sure.
No. And again, all we do in the off season, I mean, I'll turn to the baseball mode sometime in January, mm-hmm. But I'm still doing sales. You know how hard it is to try and sell baseball in this state in December, January, and February? It's difficult.
Yes.
And I'm not just talking tickets. I'm talking corporates that people can't wrap their mind around that it's eventually going to warm up. And so they're like, you know, call me in a month, call me whatever. And that's tough. It's hard. But the one thing that I do like about being a AAA affiliate is that it's cut down on that off-season. The off-season is much shorter now than it yeah. used to be. And now, next season starts March 31st. So it starts even earlier than it
does. Does it really?
Yes, we open up in Toledo on March 31st.
That is.
They couldn't send us to a tropical place like Jacksonville or Nashville. We're
right.
going to Toledo, Ohio.
I am from Detroit.
Yeah.
I am still a Tigers fan. I know the climate in that neighborhood. I mean, Toledo is 45 minutes from Detroit,
yep.
give or take.
Yep.
It is not great that time
no.
of year.
No.
I have been to many a season opener at Tiger Stadium where it was snowing.
Yeah.
And it was not pleasant
no.
out.
No, and we're home April the 4th, so our home game is April the 4th. So, and we got a taste of April baseball this year. We've
sure.
never played in April.
Really?
Yeah, we always started in mid-May.
Wow.
And so even last year when we were first year of AAA, they cut off the first
month.
Well,
last year was also sort of still coming out of COVID.
But that's
to
the
a
thing.
Degree,
we were originally scheduled to start in April, but
oh,
they pushed everything
okay.
back a month because
right.
of that. So last year we started in May, and here we are this year in April, and we found out real fast that it is not the same
no.
at all.
No.
So.
No, April baseball and May baseball are very
yeah,
different
it's,
things.
It's tough. It's tough to draw.
Sure.
It really, it's
oh,
difficult
I bet,
to draw.
I bet.
So, you know, it's one of those things we've got to figure it out.
So what's the biggest challenge do you see of being a sports broadcaster in this day and age where there are so many options
mm-hmm.
and they're all literally in yeah. your hand all the time with a phone or a tablet or something like that. How do you attack that as a broadcaster?
Yeah, I mean, I think the bigger question that you're perhaps asking is how do you set yourself apart from anybody that wants to jump on a microphone
oh,
and do their
I
thing?
I like that question. Let's pretend that was
Look, because to me, my job is my job. It doesn't change just because you can be a broadcaster or I can be a broadcaster. When I put on the headset at night, my goal is always the same. It's to paint a picture, tell a story, and weave the backgrounds and the stories of these players into a broadcast. But my ultimate goal is not to work for the St. Paul Saints. I love it here. They treat me exceptionally well.
Yeah.
But anyone in this office will tell you that my goal is to be a major league broadcaster. And so how do you separate yourself from everybody else that's out there that want the same job? Look, if Corey Provis left tomorrow, the Twins would get 200, you know, resumes and demos to take his job as the radio broadcaster.
I think you're underselling, but yes,
yeah,
probably,
but
yes.
But that's what it is. Oh, let's put it this way, 200 qualified people.
Yes.
You know, and so you've got to be able to separate yourself from mm-hmm. those people. And that's the hard thing, you know, and you start to question yourself when you've been around this long and you haven't gotten a sniff, am I good enough to be a major league broadcaster? I think I'm good enough to be where I'm at right now, even though I didn't quote unquote earn my way to be a AAA broadcaster. My big joke now is if you want to become a AAA broadcaster, wait around for 20 years and have someone pay millions of dollars and you too can become a AAA broadcaster. That's how it happened for me. I wasn't hired to be a AAA broadcaster, but here I am. So I've got to make the most of this opportunity in the backyard of now where the Twins are going to tune into more broadcasts than they ever have. And how can I utilize that if, you know, Provis goes down, I don't think they'd ever put me on TV, but if Dick Bramer went down or if they needed someone in an absolute pinch, would they call on me to slide me over? And so that has to be my initial goal.
But I certainly understand your point, but yes, you didn't quote unquote earn your way to AAA, but you're certainly good enough that they've kept you.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you've got that going for you.
Look, I'm not a total schlub on the air. I mean, I'm not, you know, but I was told this my intern year in Colorado Springs. Dan Karcher, who was the longtime voice of the Colorado Springs Sky Sox at the time, the AAA affiliate of the Rockies. Mm-hmm. And he said, look, he said, if you want to be, we have dogs in this office. They walk around all the time. If you want to be a broadcaster in this business, you have to do more than just broadcast. Right. And he said, you've got to learn to sell. Because if you can sell and bring in, see, this is what it's like in this office. People want to know. This dog never comes to my office ever, and now all of a sudden it's taken.
It's because there's some random guy in here.
But if you want to be a broadcaster, you got to learn to sell.
Yeah.
And you're going to separate yourself from other broadcasters that just want to do that if you can bring money into a team. And so I took that to heart, and I've been selling ever since. Even my intern year, I sold pretty much full time.
Wow.
And I hate it. I can't stand selling.
No.
But you do it because you realize it gets you to the bigger goal.
Sure. Absolutely. So. And I can appreciate that as a, you know, I want to just be a journalist and not have to worry. I'd love to just write the articles and do the interviews and edit the podcast and do all these things and not have to worry about, you know, selling ads. But sometimes that's part of the game.
Exactly.
You got to do it in a small organization. So I get that. So what was it that led you to broadcast? What were you, was this always the goal as being a baseball broadcaster?
Yeah, 8, 9 years old, maybe even younger. Like, I was fortunate. I grew up in Southern California, just outside of Los Angeles.
Oh, so you had Vin.
Exactly. And so that's what I grew up listening. And I always allude to Vin, but in all fairness, I grew up in perhaps one of the greatest eras of broadcasting in Los Angeles sports history. You had Vin Scully doing the Dodgers, you had Chick Hearn doing the Lakers, and you had Bob Miller doing the LA Kings. Yep. All three of them are Hall of Famers.
Oh, they're three of the greatest in their sports.
Yeah, and I grew up as fans of all three teams, mm-hmm. and so that's how I learned each of those sports, is by listening to those guys.
Yeah.
And so when you listen to them, and they make it sound so effortless, and I'm like, that's so cool. And then at some point you realize, look, I'm not growing. I'm 5'5", and I was never growing past that. Very kind to myself, average athletic talent only took me so far, and that was, you know, through high school. Mm-hmm. And I realized, you know, that the sports route was never going to be, mm-hmm. and I had no aspirations of teaching, of being a coach. And the next best thing was to talk about it. And so this was always the path that I was on.
I grew up with Ernie Harwell in Detroit, and, you know, great broadcasters for all, you know, the Pistons and the Red Wings as well. But I mean, to me, Ernie Harwell was the voice that put me to sleep every night, was sneaking listen to the Tigers games on the radio when I should have been sleeping.
Exactly.
And it was the best. It was just, you know, it was a different era also.
Well, it was simpler times, right? Yes. Like a lot of the ways, I mean, nowadays you can get every broadcast in the palm of your hand. You can tune into any broadcast you want. But back then, I mean, it was transistor radio or your clock radio in your room or whatever it was. And I was the same way. I'd go to sleep listening to whatever the time of the year was, that sport and those broadcasters. And that's exactly how I did it. And a lot of what I learned was muscle memory. I didn't go to a broadcasting school. I went to the University of Colorado at Boulder.
Right.
It is not a renowned broadcasting school. And so a lot of what I took early on in my career was, I mean, my 10,000 hours was just listening to those guys.
Right.
And you develop your skill set over the course of time the more you do it.
Right.
But I didn't join the radio club when I was in college. I didn't take advantage of a lot of things in college. I just thought I was going to graduate and someone was going to offer me a job because I wanted to be a broadcaster. Kids, that is not the way it works. and so, you know, it's taken a long time to get to where I am at.
And I think now it's even harder with all of the outlets and the streaming and the, you know, there's, you know, so many ways to do it and anybody can do it.
Yeah.
Like it's for better or worse.
Yeah. We live in a viral world, right? Yep. Like if you can, there's a guy in our industry who worked in the same league as I did when we were in the American Association. His name is Joey Zanaboni. And Joey has found the niche to go viral and turn it into multiple opportunities. And I've said this about Joey, is he is one of the more creative people that I've ever come in contact with. I couldn't do what he does. You can look him up, and he's widely creative with his turn of phrase. He uses similes unlike anybody I've ever seen use a simile before. I'll never forget when we were in the same league together, at the end of a game, he came out and he asked me, he said, "Hey, Sean, what's your favorite simile?" Which is a question nobody's ever asked me before and stumped me. But what he's found a way of doing is getting away from what I like to call the white noise, where we all sound similar, all sound the same type of thing. But that's not me, and that's not my style. And I've always been told that who you are in your life is the same person you should be on the air. Because if you try to sound like something else, it's going to come across disingenuous.
Right.
So my personality in life is the same as it is on the broadcast. I try to channel what would interest me if I were listening to the game, and I go from there. And then I'm very sarcastic. I'm very dry, and I carry that over. And either you're going to like me or you don't.
Right. And the listener is going to know.
Yes.
And that's the amazing thing. The listener will always know if you're real or you're full of it.
Yes,
100%. Which is amazing.
100%. And like I've had people that, you know, don't like, you know, myself, but that's fine. I can't kowtow to every, if you have, to put this in simple terms, if you have 100 people that listen to you, there's no way you're getting all 100 people to like you. And so if one person doesn't like you, you can't cater to that one person.
You've got to be at the Ernie Harwell, Vin Scully level to have. Even then, I don't think you'll get everybody liking them. But
but you're going to get a good majority.
People like that are going to get more of a room than most.
Yes. Yeah. And there are plenty of amazing broadcasters out there that have reached the pinnacle of this profession. And kudos to them. But again, you're right. We're in a different day and age. Yeah. You hate to say never, but are we going to get a Vin Scully or Ernie Harwell again? I mean, that's so hard because a lot of these guys don't want to stick with their teams for that long.
Right.
The great thing is about some of these guys, they were there forever. I mean, now everybody wants to be national, and that's the big. I'm a big fan of Joe Buck, but there is no more divisive broadcaster than Joe Buck. You either love the guy or hate the guy, and I mean hate the guy. And it's amazing to me those people that don't like him.
Joe Buck's Twitter bio used to say, "I like every team but yours."
Yes, exactly.
Which is hilarious.
He gets it. I've had the privilege of meeting him and interviewing him
in
a different lifetime when I was doing a podcast. One of the nicest guys around, and he understands himself. He gets where he is in the hierarchy of things. But here's a guy that's been widely successful, and I asked him straight up, I was like, "Do you go to therapy because of all the negativity you hear?" And he says, "Yes, it's the only thing that helps me." Mm-hmm. And I mean, it was a very raw, you know, admittance that he goes to therapy, which again, people don't understand that athletes, broadcasters, any of these people that you watch are real people.
Right.
And you cannot like someone, that's fine. But the vitriol that people throw at others is just, it's unbelievable to me.
Yeah. I was having a sort of Twitter conversation with somebody who I've become friendly with and talked to before for a different podcast, who wrote a book on the, who co-authored a book on the toxicity of hockey.
Yeah.
And hockey fans and the gatekeeping that goes on. And, you know, there is a broadcaster for ESPN who is a female who is just taking, who openly said how much just misogynistic, hateful messages she's gotten. You know, my response to this was, she's not my cup of tea as a broadcaster, like doing play by play. as a, you know, in between the benches, I think she's fine as a reporter down there. It's not my thing as a play-by-play, you know, but that's fine. No, but not everybody is, like, as you said, not everybody is going to be for everybody. But to, like, be misogynistic and horrible about it, like, you could just not say anything. Like, that would be okay, too.
Yeah, it
I know that's not how that works. Now, it's naive of me to suggest that it might be.
Yeah, I think most people out there can agree social media is a cesspool. It really is. Not that there aren't good things about it, but it has turned into a cesspool. I am very passive on social media. And the only reason I jumped on social media about 5 or 6 years ago is because I started a podcast and I was like, all right, I've got to promote this thing. But that was it.
Yeah.
And I am very passive on it because, A, I don't want anyone to misinterpret my sarcasm. B, I don't want to get into any back and forth. And I'm the type of person that, like, if you come after me, I'm going to come after you. And it's just a bad combination. So I won't do it. I don't want to feed into that. Mm-hmm. And that's it. I refuse to allow myself to go down that path.
I have gotten better as I've gotten a little bit older. And to use a baseball analogy, I have stopped swinging at pitches in the dirt.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That come with some of the negative comments. Yeah. It is really hard because you take a lot of that stuff personally, and it gets really hard to avoid it at times.
Yeah. Like, I'm all open to intellectual human discussions.
Absolutely.
But people on there don't want to do that. And that's part of the problem is that there are a lot of people out there that just want to troll, right? They want to get that reaction. Now they've done that, and great. But it's... You don't know who's on the other side of things.
That's right.
Because it would be very different if they sat in front of you. Like, I'm all for people that have different views and values than I do. I have no problem talking to those people.
Right.
I have family members that have different values
right.
than I do.
That's right.
And we disagree on a lot of things politically and everything else. But at least I can have an intellectual discussion with them. You can't do that with someone on the other side of a keyboard. You just can't do it.
No.
But I believe that having different views makes us a better society and makes people better and more well-rounded. It's in how you go about discussing those is where we've gone into a totally, you know, negative way in this world. And it's just, it's gotten bad. It's gotten terrible.
Yeah.
So.
Well, we're going to end things on a totally, totally different non-baseball, sure. totally lighter note that will hopefully end on a slightly happier sure. note than that, yeah. that little turn. What is your favorite Jewish food?
That's a great question. I'm a fan of a good potato latke, honestly. I'm a fan of that. But there's a few. Well, first of all, take me to any great Jewish deli and I'm all set. Like, I could
You're
be
fine. Okay.
Yeah, I'd be great.
Okay.
I mean, I haven't traveled to New York very often, but I did go to Katz's Deli when I was out there the one time. It was phenomenal. There's a great Jewish deli in Indianapolis where we travel. It's phenomenal.
Really?
Shapiro's.
Okay.
And about half our staff came to a weekend series in Indianapolis this year, and I said, I want to take you guys to a place I go probably 5 of the 6 days that I'm here. And to see, I think there were 10 people, all non-Jews, and to see how happy it made them to eat pastrami on rye, or I bought everyone a black and white cookie, or, like, it made me happy just to see that and give them a little taste of what it's like.
Yeah.
I'm actually a fan of gefilte fish, which a lot of people are not. I do enjoy gefilte fish. I don't eat it very often.
Right.
But I actually like it.
Yes. Same here. I am happier when other people make it, either make it or, you know, defrost it or open up the jar.
Yeah.
Either that's fine. I don't need to have it often, but like once in a while at the holidays, that's fine with me. But have gotten gefilte fish as an answer to that before. Yeah. So that's not all that unusual. And what is your favorite Jewish holiday?
Oh, man. That's a good question. You know, I would tell you over the last 6 or 7 years, and maybe you don't get this very often, but Yom Kippur has become one of my favorite because I genuinely use it as a time of reflection.
Mm-hmm.
We used to have another guy in this office that was Jewish. He no longer works with us, but he gave me this idea and I thought it was brilliant. Every Yom Kippur, he writes a reflection paper where he just sits back and writes just free form, just lets his thoughts go about things in his life in the past year and you know, whatever it may be. And I sort of adopted that. And it's a very cleansing type of moment.
Yeah.
Because I mean, anybody knows, you know, you're fasting and it's, you know, it's a tough day.
Yeah.
And there gets a point in the day where, you know, you're not totally focused, right? I mean, you're starving, you're hungry, you can't wait, whatever. And to see where your mind goes when you're writing this, and again, I just make it a page or two. It's nothing mm-hmm. lengthy. To me, is very, it's amazing. Can I tell you a funny young
Please.
Trooper story? So this was 2 years ago now, and I think every Jewish person can appreciate the Jewish mother. And so I'm probably the most Jewish person in my family, which is not saying much. The bar is not high.
Okay.
Both my parents were Jewish, but not, you know, like they were not practicing.
Okay.
My sister was not bat mitzvahed. It wasn't important to her. And so a couple of years ago, it's Yom Kippur, and the night before, so it starts at sundown, my nieces, everyone lives in California, they have a dance recital, which you can watch on your phone
sure.
now. But I turn everything off, right? I make it a point, like no electronics, no yeah. nothing. And so I wasn't there to watch this. I wasn't on the text chain that my family was on. And my mom started to get worried. So she texted that night. I didn't respond. The next day she texted, and apparently either forgetting it was Yom Kippur or whatever. I don't
sure.
know. So about 2 o'clock that day, you know, and the sun sets at whatever, 6:30, 7 o'clock, cop car pulls up to my house and knocks on the door. And I look terrible because, you know, whatever. I don't belong to a synagogue here, but I do watch services based out of New York that stream. And
oh,
so
sure.
I've done that. And I do that every year. And so I look terrible. My hair's a mess, whatever, you know. And they knock on the door and they said, are you Sean? And I said, yes. And I said, they said, well, we've gotten a call that from your family. They're very worried about you because they haven't heard from you. I said, they haven't heard from me since yesterday afternoon, and they're putting out an APB. Are you kidding me? And I just shook my head, and I said, I'm very sorry. And they're like, well, you'd be surprised how often this happens. And I said, my family lives in California. I said, it's Yom Kippur. And not that these cops knew what that meant.
Sure.
They had no idea what that meant.
Of course not.
But so last year on my social media pages, I posted Yom Kippur's tomorrow. I'm just letting everyone know that I'm okay in case my mom wants to call the cops and check up on me. And so that's the Jewish mother, though, right? Is like
yes.
very, very worried. It's been less than 24 hours. And so she called the cops from California to have them come and check on me to make sure I was still alive.
That is the greatest Yom Kippur story I've ever heard. Amazing. And the most Jewish mother story as well.
Yeah,
all
right?
At the same time.
It's unbelievable.
Well, Sean Aronson, thank you so much for having me in your office and getting to chat. And best of luck to you and the Saints as the season comes into the final few weeks.
I appreciate it, Lonnie. This has been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Who the Folk podcast is part of the JewFolk Podcast Network, a product of JewFolk Inc. Please subscribe, rate, and review the show wherever you get your podcasts. If you have suggestions for other podcast guests, please email them to me at editor@tcjewfolk.com. For our other shows, check out tcjewfolk.com/podcast.